This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, you're listening to Bite Size Business Breakfast. Everything Tom, Rich and myself have been into this morning, which includes digging into that announcement from Emaar that it's going to invest 1.5 billion dirhams building another 240 shops and restaurants in the luxury sector in Dubai Mall. We have a bog off this morning of retail experts. Two for the price of one. We've been speaking to Andrew Love, the head of commercial at Knight Frank, and Taimer Khan, who is the regional head of research for CBRE, to look at the health of the retail sector. Do we need a bigger mall? And what about the infrastructure around our malls at the moment? Traffic in and out. Enough parking, the roads, and indeed whether as Dubai gets bigger and bigger, the big mall model actually still works. And we've also been taking a look at which airlines are top of the pops at the moment. AirlineRatings.com have actually been rating airlines. We've been speaking to the managing director, Jeff Thomas. And UAE authorities have shut down more than 1,000 sites offering illegal access to streaming services and things like dodgy boxes and dodgy sticks. We've been speaking to James Dunn, who is head of trademarks and brand protection at the law firm Hadif & Partners, about that crackdown, and to the head of one streaming service, Maz Sheikh, co-founder and CEO of StarsPlay. We are speaking to a man about a mall now on the Business Breakfast. On the back of Emaar investing 1.5 billion dirhams in Dubai Mall, that is another 240 luxury stores in F&B, we're going to have a look at if we need it. Andy Love heads the commercial agency at Knight Frank. Morning, Andy.
Morning, Brandy. How are you?
I'm well, my friend. Do we need a mega mall? A bigger mega mall? A mega mall?
I don't know about Mega Mall, but certainly an expansion of Dubai Mall is probably welcomed. I think it was announced end of last year that it was the most visited place on earth, with almost 300,000 visitors a day and with vacancy at virtually 0%. I think this will be a welcome addition.
Tell me how the retail sector is doing in general. What do rents look like at the moment?
Very healthy, actually. I was speaking to our retail colleague yesterday. Number of inquiries, a lot of which actually we cannot always help because vacancy is so low. You know, you just have to drive down Sheikh Zayed Road. There is virtually no vacancy, which in turn provides problems for retailers and automotive groups.
How are the rents working out, though, in terms of turnover? Because there's a metric for this in the industry, isn't there?
Yeah, it's called the OCR, which is the occupancy cost ratio, which is essentially your effort rate. And it's very healthy when you speak to the mall owners.
What does the fact that this is 240 luxury stores tell us, though? Who's actually spending here?
Well, I think all brands are doing pretty well, especially in the luxury segment. I think you had the gentleman from Duty Free yesterday, and you know he announced that the Middle East is spending higher proportionately than the rest of the world, and retailers are benefiting from that, particularly across F&B, fashion, lifestyle. And as I said, we've now even seen automotive dealers come back into market, particularly in the EV segments, all looking to expand, but unfortunately not enough space.
Because you're limited, aren't you? You've just mentioned the EVs, and we know that Lucid has just opened its first Dubai showroom. Sheikh Zayed Road is the place to be for showrooms, but I can't think of an awful lot of space that is road-facing to build another one. Is that an issue?
Yeah, it definitely is an issue. And in talking about rents, we've probably seen rent almost doubled, maybe tripled along Sheikh Zayed Road in the last 3 years. So I think what you will now happen is, and you've seen this actually, we've seen it with some of the automotive groups now move one street back, two streets back into Al-Khoz. I think is it G-Tour who have now opened a showroom one street back.
There's zoning though that affects them and where they can do that, isn't there?
There is, but Al-Khoz has been rezoned essentially. You now have what is called the Creative District Culture Makers Market. And now we're seeing actually landowners and warehouse owners look to repurpose their warehousing facilities, rebuild them. And I suspect in the next two to three years, you will see a lot more Al-Sirkal type avenue shopping districts pop up in this area.
What about the infrastructure, though, to get into, again, these big malls, particularly in the summer months, more people looking to do things indoors? I drove past this weekend, one of our big malls, massive queues to get into it. And presumably the mall owners are limited in what they can do about that.
Yeah, you'll have to speak to the RTA and Mater Altaïr on that. But, you know, I suspect they'll look to enter into more cost-sharing agreements so that developers, an obligation passes onto them to put more infrastructure into these major infrastructure projects.
Look, while we've got you on the line, Andy, I'm going to let you go in a second, but one of our other big news stories this morning is that the Cove Rotana in Ras Al Khaimah has changed hands. No price that's been disclosed on that deal, but you're a man who has sold a couple of hotels. How often do hotels actually change hands?
Look, until probably, I would say, 2022, wasn't that frequent, maybe one or two hotels a year. I can tell you now there's probably at least a hotel selling every month or every second month, which is, you know, for someone like myself, is fantastic. It's great for the market. It's actually putting us on a par with London now in terms of hotel transaction volumes, which, you know, I think gives confidence in the sector.
Why are they changing hands more?
I think you've probably had, you know, some period of tough years, especially, you know, leading up to COVID and then into COVID. So this is now an opportunity for asset owners to essentially exit their hotels with higher or fair market valuations that they previously couldn't have obtained with lower occupancy rates and ADRs.
Well, look, I know that you have done in the last couple of years a massive deal in Ras Al Khaimah. This is a Ras Al Khaimah hotel as well. Are we seeing particular interest in the moment in rack hotels being bought and sold?
Look, I think rack hotels have done particularly well over the last few years. I don't think we'll see too many more transactions. There's certainly been a lot of land transactions in the last 2 years. I can think of at least 20 plots that have been bought. And the developers or the asset owners of those plots will probably now look to build out more hotels. And as and when them come online, they might then transact. But I think as a market as a whole, I think you'll start to see more hotel transactions in the UAE. Generally speaking, that could be in Abu Dhabi and Dubai.
Andy Love heads the commercial agency at Knight Frank, speaking to us this morning, not just about that expansion of Dubai Mall, 1.5 billion dirhams, but also what we're seeing in the hotel transaction space as well.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Right, having a look at one of the big stories of the morning, and that's Emaar investing 1.5 billion dirhams to build another 240 luxury stores and F&B in Dubai Mall. Very pleased to be speaking now to Taimer Khan, who's the head of research at CBRE. Taimer, good morning. Thanks for speaking to us.
Good morning, Brandy. Thank you for having me.
What do we know about what they're doing there at Dubai Mall?
So the details at the moment are still at the early stages, but this is quite a significant expansion, as Richard said earlier. Around 240 new stores coming in, about 20% increase in terms of total store count. But I think it'll be quite a significant increase in the total GLA of Dubai Mall, which is at capacity, effectively, and the demand is very, very significant. I mean, the retail side of it is able to choose very selectively who goes in at the moment.
Right, so that's gross leasable area. You say it's near capacity. What's that doing in general for malls across Dubai in terms of rents?
In the year to Q1, we've been talking about this for a while. This has been the issue for about a year and a half now. Rents in the year to Q1 increased by around 15%. About 11% in Dubai, but across the UAE we're seeing this as well, in Abu Dhabi increasing by around 15%, and it's quite a significant increase to where we started pre-COVID, where supply or lack of supply was the other side of the pendulum.
What about the infrastructure around these big malls? It's all very well building more shops, but you also need more parking, more slip roads, more ramps.
Yeah, indeed. When you have quite an expansion in the level of supply coming in, looking at that, and this is part of the developments which happen, there's normally a traffic study done, which will incorporate that additional footfall, inflow into this. I'm sure that'll be accounted for. The great thing about Dubai Mall is the access to the metro and the bus services which exist into it. But that'll be studied quite significantly. Obviously, historically, we've seen the Zabil parking come into play as well. It'll be interesting to see how parking is catered for in the future. It is quite open at the moment.
We're talking here about luxury shops and luxury space, but what about in the rest of the industry? We've got a lot of older malls here in Dubai. We've got a lot of community malls. Is everyone at zero vacancy, or are we seeing some issues with lower grade stock?
We had historically seen that the secondary stock, not necessarily community, but secondary older grade assets were not seeing the same trends occurring. So demand was very much sort of focused on towards a prime and the grade A stock within the market. As the lack of space has become quite a bit of an issue, but importantly, as catchment areas around these secondary assets have increased, there's a lot more sort of population as well. We've seen a lot of the landlords actively going and repositioning the assets and the retailers who are within there as well. And if you look at some of these community malls, if you look at sort of neighborhood centers as well, they're actually doing incredibly well.
And that's my next question. It's not just the traffic in and out of the malls, but traffic in general. As it takes longer to get from A to B, what does that actually mean for the big central mall model?
I think it's, look, over the last decade, it used to be the case, even if you potentially wanted a small shop, you might go to a large mall and you could get in reasonably quickly. I think what we've seen over the last 5 years, as the population has increased quite significantly, that localized amenities, that catchment of sort of about 10 to 15 minutes is incredibly important. And actually, the average person in Dubai is much more likely to go to a smaller, more localized offering, at least more frequently. These large assets, such as Dubai Mall and others, will always have quite a significant draw. We'll always go there. We're just not going there as frequently as we may have previously done so.
What does the tightness of occupancy in malls mean for the consumer at the end of the day? I bought a skirt a wee while ago from a UK retailer in a big mall. And you know now, you've got price transparency, what stuff costs online. I asked why it was more expensive here than elsewhere. And I was told, well, we've got high rent. Does it pass down?
I think to a degree. I think if you compare to where we were historically, at least in my opinion, I think the price disparity has come together a bit more. We used to see quite a significant premium here compared to where we were in other parts of the world. I think less and less are people going back to their home countries and then purchasing there and bringing it here. And the online model is helping with that as well. As you say, that helps with the price discovery quite significantly from whilst you're out and about.
Before we let you go, Tamer, how often do we see retail space changing over, shops moving from place to place? Richard, what was the great expression that you had earlier when we do see the hoardings up?
Smashed teeth is the one that David McAdam of the Middle East Council of Shopping Centres and Retailers introduced us to. When you've got a shop and then hoardings and a restaurant and then hoardings, it looks like smashed teeth and nobody likes them.
Yeah, so how often do shops actually get up and move, Tamer?
It's a good question. I think, off the top of my head, I don't have a number to give you. But I think if you walk around some of the sort of major assets in Dubai, there's very little smashed teeth around right now.
There we go. Full smiles. Tamer Khan is head of research for CBRE, speaking to us this morning about the health of the retail sector on the back of that massive investment, 1.5 billion dirhams, to increase the gross leasable area of Dubai Mall by about 20%. Thank you for your time this morning.
What we haven't had in, we've had lots of messages this morning, and thank you for those. But we haven't had messages about that newish bit of Dubai Mall, the Zabil bit, that we've driven past many times, but never been in. You've not been in, have you, Tom?
Not knowingly. I don't know if I've been in inadvertently. Is it one of those ones that you can sort of wander into without realising you're there? Because they're connected, aren't they?
Yes, they're connected, but I think it's a walkway. But again, we just don't... Brandy, have you been into the new Zabili bit of Dubai Mall, knowingly?
I'm with Tom. I'm not sure if I've actually crossed the border.
Yeah. You might have just wandered, because you wander in mall, in Dubai Mall, and you sort of happen upon different areas.
I know there's a bit near the kind of China Mall, and you can inadvertently...
Which I also still think of as new, by the way.
Well, it is new.
Yeah.
And you don't know that some of it's built on a bridge. It's like the... Anyway, Zabil bit of Dubai Mall. What's going on there?
One would like to think that had you walked across that road, because you'd have to go over that road or under that road, you'd know you were doing that, wouldn't you?
You'd have thought so.
Yeah.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Right, talking intellectual property and looking after it this morning. The UAE authorities have blocked more than 1,000 websites that violate IP guidelines. Very pleased to be joined this morning by James Dunn. He's the Head of Trademarks and Brand Protection at the law firm Hediff & Partners. James, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Brandy. A pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So more than 1,100 websites have been blocked here in the UAE. Why have they been held up for violating IP guidelines? What do we know?
Well, there's a variety of different reasons, but this is part of an initiative which was launched earlier in March this year, really promoting IP aspects across a range of different areas. In this regard, it's primarily focused on copyright. And it's part of a global crackdown on illegal streaming, where essentially unauthorized users are streaming content that they shouldn't be, which is a massive problem around the world. And this is one of the steps that the UAE is taking to address that.
Because I look at the companies who it's their content that the rights have been upheld. And yes, it is NBC, it is OSN, it is BN, it is indeed Abu Dhabi Media Network, the people who provide the shows and the sports that we like to watch. Is this a crackdown on the dodgy box, James?
Yes. It's one where I suppose one of the issues people are finding is, on the one hand, people are thinking, this isn't fair, I want to watch my favourite show from back home, especially in a city full of expats. What people don't realise is the economic loss that that causes to content creators and content owners like NBC, Bean and the like. So the United States last year was estimated was a $30 billion loss of revenue through illegal streaming, affecting tens of thousands of jobs. And that's the same here in the UAE. It's affecting content creators as well and really infringing their rights.
OK, so when we've cracked down on these websites, and I'm just using generic dodgy box for any way that someone might be getting hold of streaming services illegally. I have heard that it happens. What does that crackdown look like? Does the service just disappear?
So what they're targeting is really twofold. One is the actual portal where it would allow the website to be accessed, so essentially the intermediary service providers. And it's part of a two-step process. Again, this is global at the moment, so the UAE, once again, is aligning with best practices in the world. So it's a two-pronged approach, one on the content that's being streamed and the websites that are hosting it, and secondly is on the dodgy boxes or the dodgy sticks, which are actually facilitating people to access these websites. So it's a two-pronged approach, both from the electronic side and the physical hardware side.
Who gets in trouble?
Well, it depends who you catch. So if you look at sort of the providers of the dodgy boxes or dodgy sticks, they're target number one. Secondly, then will be the operators of the websites, which will be target number two. So again, you'll find that they're often different entities, different players, sometimes not even in the UAE, they're elsewhere around the world. And this is why this effort is part of a coordinated worldwide move against infringers and essentially providers of illegal online content to really crack down from both sides on a global basis.
Other than just having the site, the service, the stick, the box, whatever it is, deemed inactive or shut down, what are the penalties?
Well, they can be severe. So you're looking at jail time, financial penalties. Our cyber crimes law, for example, prohibits the use of circumvention measures to get around, essentially, lockdowns. So the use of a dodgy box or a dodgy stick will potentially expose you not only to breaches under the cybercrimes law, but also under copyright law as well. So it's not something to be taken lightly.
And this is the question. So for the actual user of said get around for streaming services, not the people providing the services whose numbers being shared on WhatsApp or whatever else, but for whoever is sitting home in, you know, the Springs, the Greens, wherever else, accessing the BBC iPlayer, I don't know, pulling it out of thin air here, James, What happens to them, potentially?
Well, there's always a risk, and there's two risks, really, and it's good to probably split how the UAE is dealing with it at the moment versus other countries. So at the moment, it's really focusing on the online content providers. In other countries around the world, they've actually gone after the end users. So, for example, in Spain, there was a decision earlier this year that people who were using illegal streaming boxes to download or watch La Liga games, those ISPs, the details of those users were being provided to La Liga to take action directly against those users. So that is something that potentially could happen here. One of the other risks, which leaving aside the intellectual property, is the issue of the hardware and software that you're downloading. So on the one hand, as you say, the hypothetical person in Springs might not necessarily be at the receiving end of a copyright infringement claim by NBC, but what they are doing is downloading or using software that someone somewhere around the world has hacked. They're pushing it onto their computer where all the personal data is stored and potentially exposing themselves to have their banking details compromised, passwords corrupted. It's something, if you think about it from an end user perspective, isn't actually the wisest thing to do.
Are they technically, though, is there something on the books where they're breaking the law or opening themselves up to penalty?
Absolutely. What you are doing is you are using essentially devices that are illegal. And that really is the crux of the matter for, say, the end user, the common person on the street. Now, the issue is that will they become a target? Potentially, yes. And that is a risk. So it'll be interesting to see what direction the UAE goes with that. At the moment, it's easier to actually remove the ability to access the websites or to have the devices that actually enable access to the illegal content. But I think it's something where if there's prolific use or becomes an issue, this is something that may be on the horizon in the not-too-distant future.
How easy actually is it to crack down on the provision of these things? Is it not a game of whack-a-mole that the moment you hit one, another one pops up?
Absolutely. And that's the issue. And it is part of this global problem at the moment. So, for example, you have various countries around the world, like Italy, for example, have an equivalent, which is Privacy Shield, that had 10,000 websites taken down in just over 2 months. So it's an issue, as you say, whack-a-mole is really a very good way of describing it. So I think a lot of this will be education to the end user about why it's wrong. So you're not taking away from big business, as is often the case, or the fact that you want to watch something from back home, but there's a lot behind it from an education perspective. I think if your earlier commenter about the airlines and the fuel usage, for example, a lot of this is education. It's letting the public know, here's why it's wrong and here's the adverse effects of it.
How well does that education work, though? I mean, we've seen it a lot with fake designer goods, haven't we? And in fact, I've spoken to the CEO of a very posh watch brand who used to go down towards Karama, and we're talking 20 years ago, and explained to anyone who was selling rip-off watches why it was damaging his business. I'm going to guess they didn't care. I mean, people don't necessarily care about the profits of big brands. We've had one message in this morning from someone saying, if you lower subscriptions, I've just lost it here, if you lower subscriptions, then the issue would disappear. The sympathy is not necessarily with big business.
That's always the case with many IP matches where someone is seen to be perhaps a profiteer or making huge profits. But in relation to that, for example, a lot of this is very complex licensing agreements all around the world where, for whatever reason, you're simply not able to show the show in a particular jurisdiction. And I think that's the issue, and you're quite right, is the education side of it, when people realise it's a lot more complex, but also the threat to themselves of potentially having your data compromised. That then, I think, might sort of really focus the attention on the risk.
Well, there you go. Speaking to James Dunn this morning, Head of Trademarks and Brand Protection at Hadiff and Partners. UAE authorities cracking down on 1,100 websites, just over, that violate IP guidelines from some of the biggest broadcasters and streamers, NBC, OSN and BN among them. Thank you very much for your time.
Absolute pleasure.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
As the great and good of the aviation world descend on Dubai this week for the International Air Transport Association, AGM. First time here in the Emirates. What better time to talk all things aviation with a man very much with his finger on the pulse, the Managing Director and Editor-in-Chief of AirlineRatings.com, Geoffrey Thomas, has been kind enough to join us on the show this morning. Geoff, really appreciate your time. First, I mean, just before we move into your latest top 25 airlines in the world, which you've just released, the significance of IATA coming to Dubai for the first time for an AGM?
Look, it's very significant. Dubai is one of the great hubs of the world. Emirates is the largest international airline. So, yes, I mean, not only, of course, have we got Emirates in Dubai, you've got Etihad over in Abu Dhabi, you've got Qatar Airways in Qatar. I mean, you know, you've got three of the biggest players in the international space all within, 30 minutes flying or an hour's drive. So, yeah, it is significant, and it reflects the importance of Emirates and Dubai in the world aviation stage.
So what they really need when you've got all these CEOs under one roof is they need a list so they can have a bit of bragging rights as to who's got a better airline than others. And guess what? Your organisation, airlineratings.com, have put out your top 25 airlines in the world the first day of this conference itself. Qatar Airways is 2024's airline of the year, according to you guys. Why?
Well, look, we have about 12 parameters which we judge these airlines, and we give them scores. We look at their safety rating, their product rating. We look at the fleet age. We look at whether they've got a good environmental track record. We look at profitability. We also look at about three different sources for passenger rating feedback from ourselves, people like TripAdvisor. And we aggregate all the scores and put them together and come out with a top 25 airlines. It's, mind you, it's very close at the top. I mean, there's very little between the top five and even the top 10. We are served by, really very, very good airlines who are competing ferociously for passengers' custom.
It makes you mentioned there about just how close the top 10 is, but one thing we can tell about the top 10 or the list as a whole, the 25 as you've listed them out, dominated by Middle Eastern and Asia Pacific carriers. I mean, that's not a new trend. That's something that's been developing for several years.
Look, it goes back probably 30, 40 years with the rise of Singapore Airlines and Cathay Pacific. And funnily enough, they snubbed their nose at IATA, because back in those days, back in the 60s and 70s, IATA dictated what sort of sandwiches you could give your passengers and what sort of meal you could. That's where they were focused, not on the environment, all those sort of things. And Cathay Pacific and Singapore Airlines said, no, we're going to give them free drinks. We're going to give them free headsets. Everything's going to be free. So, that started a real global trend. And, of course, with the rise of Emirates under the stewardship of the late Sir Maurice Flanagan, Sir Tim Clark, the shift has moved to the Middle East. And that's been helped, of course, by the advent of aircraft that can fly virtually nonstop anywhere in the world. And Emirates is just perfectly located to reach any spot you like, plus an aggressive focus on tourism, particularly led by Dubai, obviously. They've gone from strength to strength to strength, and they dominate aviation.
It's interesting. It's also reading into your other awards coming as part of the 25 airlines in the world. And again, it goes back to that point of Middle Eastern and Asian airlines getting best in classes. Qatar Airways winning the best business class. We've got Singapore Airlines with the best first class, best premium goes to Emirates. Again, so when you break it down from the airline over a whole into what their offerings are, it seems that the more forward thinking is coming from airlines in the region.
Look, indeed. And they are not only in the product space are they leading the world, but they're also now driving aircraft manufacturers to do better. For instance, Sir Tim Clark, I mean, he's a legend in the industry today. The 777-300ER, which is the backbone of the world's aviation fleets, long haul, it's his aeroplane. He pushed Boeing to do better. And they came to him with a mediocre solution. He said, no, give me a big engine. And that's where we got the GE90 from, which is a massive engine, powers the 777-300ER. It's the backbone of virtually every major airliner of the world, and so on and so forth. He was the driver behind the A380, Now the A350, Qatar Airways was the big order of the A350. So the Middle East airlines have really pushed both Airbus and Boeing to do better, and they have done better. So the world's now got a better range of aircraft to choose from because of the push from the Middle East carriers.
Quick mention, if we can, for low-cost carriers. I know you don't rank the low-cost carriers, but you do list the top 25 out there as well. Again, one, I suppose, is looking at the economies around the world at the moment, rising air prices as well, the cost of travel, etc. Is that why we're seeing more influence from the low-cost carriers developing over time?
Oh, look, absolutely. I mean, people are desperate to travel. They love travel. We want to move around. And, you know, cost pressures are very important. Low-cost carriers offer a really great alternative where you can sort of have the bare-bones price, or you can option up the product you really want. And, I mean, I use low-cost carriers a lot, you know, EasyJet around Europe. Yeah. And I find that I can buy the priority boarding, I can buy the extra legroom, I can buy the cheese board. And, you know, I'm a happy little camper. And I've got a very low fare, although by the time I option it up, it's not so low because I've got expensive tastes. But no, it gives passengers flexibility to get the product they really want. And look, these low-cost carriers are super efficient bus service with frills if you want it. So it's a good formula.
Really appreciate the latest rankings, 25 airlines in the world, according to airlineratings.com. Just want to get one final thought from you, given the fact that we are broadcasting in the city that is hosting IATA this week. If there's one message you want to send out to the great and the good of the world of aviation that they might discuss during their AGM and, of course, the World Air Transport Summit taking place straight after, what would that be?
We need to get our message across far more effectively about how we really lead the world in reducing the amount of fuel we use per passenger in the environmental space. Since the beginning of the jet age, we have reduced the amount of fuel burnt per passenger by 82%. And, you know, we really do lead the world in the environmental space, but we just don't tell our story properly. And it doesn't, there's no cut through to the general public. The people think aviation's the great polluter. It's so much the opposite. We're the leader in that space.
That message coming across loud and clear, I'm sure being picked up by the great and the good of the aviation industry. Geoffrey Thomas, MD, Editor-in-Chief, airlineratings.com. Thanks so much indeed for your time this morning, and we'll catch up soon.
Pleasure. Thank you.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
So we're up and running. This weekend saw the start of the ICC Men's T20 World Cup 2024 live from the United States and the West Indies. Two territories that have been reflected in the official theme tune.
This moment is all that I've been dreaming of.
Well, focus.
Somewhere. In my soul,
in my soul.
Yeah. One chance is everything we've waited for.
Shot the ball.
It's our time, so let we take it home and knock it out at this world.
Yeah, so they're up and running. In fact, we've got games underway at the moment. We've got games to look forward to throughout the rest of today as well. There's all sorts happening out there. And there's only one place that you can watch all the action right here in the region. And that's on, of course, Stars Play. Stars Play announcing its exclusive coverage of all 55 matches of the ICC T20 World Cup 2024. Maj Sheikh is the co-founder and the CEO of Stars Play. He's always been very kind with his time with us here on the Business Breakfast, and that blew a pleasure to welcome him back into the studio. Maj, good to see you.
Good morning, Tom.
Sum up how significant a deal this is for you and your customer base.
It is very significant because it's a four-year deal.
Oh, wow.
And it is exclusive. So we worked with ICC to secure the rights. And what's interesting is in the last 10 years, the format's evolved where you have one Cricket World Cup every year. So this year it's T20. Next year it'll be the one day. And so it alternates. So it gives us one major event, one major World Cup, plus the Champions Trophy each year.
cricket, we know, is a beloved sport the world over. It's a strange one here in the region. It's certainly not the national game of the region. It is certainly not the most... I'd say it was certainly one of the most played games in the region here, just in terms of the expatriate population as well. And with that comes this huge demand for coverage as well. I know that sports has been something that you and the team at Stars Play have moved into in recent years. How sort of high on the agenda was cricket, and what's the data shown you to date?
So cricket has a very interesting history, especially in UAE. You know, I remember growing up here in the 70s and going to watch cricket matches, international cricket matches in Sharjah with my dad. So cricket's always been here, given the, especially the subcontinent diaspora in UAE. So, and given, especially in UAE, given the population demographics, if you want to cut through that, those demographics and appeal to that audience, you have to have cricket, because otherwise that audience set from Indian subcontinent is very fragmented in their entertainment taste. The only thing that unites them is cricket, and over the years we've seen cricket's popularity increase outside of UAE as well, especially in Saudi. You've seen Aramco sponsor IPL. They've sponsored World Cup. So the popularity of cricket, especially from the government of Saudi as well now, and the commitment towards international cricket is building.
Yeah, no, it's something that's going to be... And I mean, you know, when I first saw the fact that it was going to be hosted over in the United States, and I get it, the ICC want to take it to new territories, obviously the West Indies fated in the past, etc. They want to open up these new territories. From a selfish point of view, I was like, ugh, I'm going to have to get up in the crack of dawn to watch this one. I do anyway, but... The timings aren't that bad, actually. I mean, we've got games on at the moment. In fact, we just got a result, Afghanistan beating Uganda convincingly. But England plays Scotland a little later on. That one's kicking off or getting underway at 6:30 this evening. That's fine for us. There's one at 7:30 this evening as well. So timings-wise, it works for you as well.
Exactly. That was one of the big decisions for us to make this sizable commitment and investment. The times are very good, actually, and especially for big matches. You know, India-Pakistan is on June 9th. Not that that's the only match that matters, but commercially, it's a very important match. You know, that's on June 9th, and the times they have chosen are around the Indian subcontinent time zones. So it works very well for us.
We've got to mention that clash, though. Yeah, you say that there are other games. I mean, this is the game that everyone's waiting for, June the 9th, when India-Pakistan will bring, well, not just New York City to a standstill, yeah. I'm sure, but the rest of the world. The anticipation ahead of this one is worth the tournament itself.
It is. And it's this time, you know, both India and Pakistan each, they've won one T20 World Cup. I think India won it in 2007 and then Pakistan won it in 2009. So they, as far as their history of T20 World Cups is concerned, they're one each. So this is going to be a very eventful match from that point of view as well. But, you know, Rohit Sharma is the Indian captain and Babar Azam is still the Pakistani captain. So it'll be an interesting match.
Looking forward to that and all the other games at this year's event. OK, how do I watch them? If I am a Stars Play customer, is there an extra that I have to pay in order to watch?
So if you're a Stars Play sports customer today, you don't have to pay extra to watch the Cricket World Cup. But if you're not a sports customer, then you have to subscribe.
Okay. And in terms of promotions, is this something that you do in order when you signed a deal like this, when you got a tournament like that, do you sort of put promotions on to bring more customers onto the platform?
We do. Until 3 days ago, we were running an early bird promotion, if you will. We're also running promotions with Visa. In the region. They're one of our credit card partners. So there were a few promotions that we were running, but those were typically sort of early bird promotions leading up to the World Cup. Now's the peak time, so we slow down on the promotions and offers.
Good business model for you in terms of bringing more eyeballs onto the platform. It's one of those events that will bring more people onto the platform, allows you to then explain what more you do. Listen, there are those out there that go, okay, yeah, but I'm not going to pay that. I'm just going to go out and watch it in a venue around town. No shortage of venues showing it. They still need to subscribe, though. So do you offer different deals for public venues?
Correct. That's like you just said, Tom, it's a public viewing contract that we have with the likes of, you know, bars and restaurants. And those deals are commercial deals, if you will. So they cannot take a consumer subscription and show it to, you know, their guests that might be in thousands. So that's a separate contract and a separate venue that we work with.
Quick one about the so-called competition. I don't know if you were listening a little early on. We had James Dunn, head of trademarks and brand protection here from Haddef and Partners. Big crackdown here in the region with regards to illegal viewing and showing as well. What's your sort of reading of the situation at the moment? Is more being done?
Yes, certainly this year it's been the Ministry of Economy and the local authorities have been quite active. There's an association of broadcasters and streamers that are working together to enforce our rights. Look, it costs the economy hundreds of millions of dollars, and that's on the low end. But you have to also keep in mind that we are local companies. We employ people locally. So when we are pirating product, we're not just hurting some no-name company. We're hurting people who are employed here, who work here, who contribute to creating this IP. And especially when you have events that are happening locally. So, for example, the Cricket World Cup was 2 years ago was in the UAE. That's when the impact on economy is even stronger because it has a knock-on effect on our ability to secure rights.
Mark's got to leave it there. Out of the time on this occasion, co-founder and CEO of Starzplay, can't thank you enough for joining us. And, of course, the coverage of this year's ICC T20 World Cup 2024. Mark Sheikh, thanks.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-sized Business Breakfast. You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.